All right, Sean, we haven't seen each other in a little while. How
it's
you
been
doing?
A bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm nursing my broken left arm.
Oh, yeah, you're out of the sling, which, you know, you arrived in the sling and you just went to the bathroom and you came out without it.
Ta-da!
And now you're typing with both hands.
Yeah. Well, you know what? When they surgically put your arm back together, as they did with mine, with plate and screws, with hardware and all that stuff, the hard part's taken care of. I do wear the sling when I go out because
you don't want someone jostling you on the subway.
Exactly. A, I don't want somebody jostling me on the subway or on the streets, and B, I want to get a seat. So.
Oh, yeah, you get to have the disabled seat. Do people actually move for you, or you just feel justified in sitting there?
I don't know. I hate to admit this, but it's kind of true that, like, I think I get a perverse thrill out of people not giving up their seat for me because I'm like, you fucking assholes. You know, I get to feel self-righteous because nothing gets you feeling more self-righteous than being injured or disabled in some way and somebody breaks the rules, you know, to fucking feel real good about that, get real mad about it.
Yeah, and nobody ever pats you on the shoulder for doing the right thing. I mean,
no.
You might get a thank you from the old lady who sits down.
I give people a nod if they do it for me. If they do it for me.
Yeah.
You know? There's something about the social compact, you know, like the self-ordering society. When we get to, because this is episode 300, right?
300. Of course, we've done much more than 300 episodes. Yeah. We've only done like 500.
We've done like 500.
But we have some wonky number system where there's like the official episodes
right.
get the number, and then the bonuses or the side projects don't. So this is 300 of our sort of our news episodes or our more collaborative interviews that we do.
Like official episodes, I'd call them. Like official. But then there was History as a Weapons. There's Prolet Cults. There's all of our little.
Yeah, what is that?
AI Karumba.
Is that all garbage because it doesn't have a number? No.
It's not.
That's the best stuff.
That's the good stuff. I know. But you know what? This is the good stuff too. And if this is episode 300, I'm going to go ahead and say that this is our Thermopylae. We're standing at the gates, athwart the gates, and we're saying none shall pass, especially if you're Persian or MAGA.
So we are the 300 Spartans.
I guess. Or do we want to be the other guys?
Yeah, we should be the degenerate Persians.
Yeah, right, with like hooks for arms
and
shit.
Yeah, the queer, freakish, transvestite Persian warriors who are just getting owned by 300.
Yeah. I think it'd be kind of
homo social men.
I'd be kind of cringe for both you and I to paint abs on ourselves too. I think we're both kind of over the hill for that shit. But what I was gonna say is that, you know, we all believe, and I've been reading a lot of like you know, good old history and philosophy. We all believe in like the idea of a self-ordering society and like there being like a social compact. One of the things, of course, being like give up your seat for the pregnant lady, right? And it feels like maybe over the last 5 years that's degraded and digressed, but like it's tough. And when we get to talking about immigration today, we'll talk about all the ways in which that idea of self-ordered society, the idea of like civil society and the workplace is like this place of exchanging the products of your labor and shit all gets fucked up when, you know, we have nation states and people separated by nationality and ethnicity and the whole self-ordered shit.
The friend-enemy distinction.
Yeah,
of course,
sure.
there's a certain kind of ordering around that as well. But I, you know, that is probably going to be a theme of this episode because there's a few news items we're going to talk about up front. And then we're going to work our way to some Q's and A's from our Discord.
People love the Q's and A's, and they are good.
Yeah, we got some good questions.
Great questions.
Just to put it out of the way, you can join our Discord by subscribing at patreon.com/theantifada for $5, $10, $15, or for the year at a discount at any of those levels.
Boom.
We really appreciate you doing that. That's what's kept us going to 300 plus, you know, 200 or however we've done. And hopefully we'll keep doing it because, you know, I guess until the revolution, we will still have to do Antifada.
Oh, God.
Maybe once we win, we'll probably be dead. You know, probably the Groundwork Caucus of the DSA will put us away somewhere. But
If not mug.
But that'll be sweet.
Yeah, it'll be great. It'll be good. It'll be good to die.
That's the best way to die.
It'll be great to die at the hands of the DSA. I'm fine with it.
Narcissism of small difference. That's the best death. Narcissism of small differences.
Yeah, it's the
Mike
best
from death. PA, you know, unleashes the gear. guillotine on me. I would be psyched. I would say, thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Thank
like
you.
And subscribe.
Smash that like button.
Yeah.
Now that I think there was an amendment passed at the most recent DSA convention that says the Dem cent is no longer canceled. Democratic centralism is now possible in that organization. Sound off in the comments if I'm completely off base. But I think it's baby steps. Now that Democratic centralism, next we get a factions ban, and then pretty soon Andy and I could face the firing squad. It'd be great. I can't wait for the DSA Cheka to take us out. It's going to be the most woke Cheka you've ever seen in
your life.
Well,
hopefully it'll be something like... what is it, the jizya tax, where since we're outside the DSA, they can't, you know, they might be able to shake us down, but they can't really harm us.
Yeah, except that I feel like you and me, we're going to be treated like Yazidis. We're going to be like outside the monotheism of the DSA. We're going to be like kafirs.
Well, I do worship Zarathustra, so that we're not too far off. But just to finish up on that plug, patreon.com/theantifada. You get all of our bonus episodes, including the aforementioned History is a Weapon. You can also buy those separately on our Patreon if you just want the individual episodes. And you get access to our Discord community. I did notice recently when I posted info about the reading group, they're currently reading Jasper Burns, The Future of Revolution. The next reading group date is on the 31st, and you can join. But I noticed when I posted about it, a lot of people were saying, where's the Discord link? Mm. And so I did some investigation, and it seems like the Discord link doesn't always show up when you sign up. So if you sign up, or if you're already signed up, and you want access to the Discord, and it's not there, just message me on Patreon. I will send you a link immediately.
Is that a paper copy? I'm in your bedroom right now. A paper copy of the International Communist Party newspaper?
Yes, it is. Thank you for noticing.
Where the hell did you get that?
At Topos Books.
That's so cool.
For free.
Remember when you and me
were... It says it's £1, but I got it for free.
You didn't even have to convert to pounds or nothing. Remember when we were in London and we got like the left communist, Martinelliist?
That was the best part of the whole trip.
Yeah, it really did it for me too. And what is that, a Spartacus paper underneath?
No, that's the challenge by the Revolutionary Communist newspaper of the Progressive Labor Party, also from Topos. Okay. And I also got this smut at Topos, Dirty Mag.
Nice. You got pornography.
With Chris Smalls on the cover. If you want to read a, you know, softcore porn mag with a profile of Chris Smalls, check out Dirty Mag.
That is a man who does not have to paint his abs on. That is a man that would stand to thwart at philopathy.
You know, sadly, Chris Smalls is not, you know, he's not one of the smutty people in here.
Well, that's just a tease, a cock tease. He's right on the cover wearing a fucking...
An A-shirt.
Yes, I almost said the bad word, but I didn't say it.
He is wearing an A-shirt.
Well, now he's like a free-floating leftist activist because he was just on a flotilla to Gaza,
and
right?
He's back.
He's trying to break the blockade.
Beat up by Israel. All right, we got a lot
to talk about. Let's go.
You want to talk about your news hit first?
Sure. You want to talk about our new stupid FDR, our new stupid state capitalism?
Yeah, walk me through this, because it doesn't. All right. It didn't sound like such a big deal to me, and I read the New York Times article, and it sounded... I would love to know how this is bad, but the New York Times article did not really explain it, so help me out here.
You say that because you're not a shareholder of a major corporation like NVIDIA or Intel or anything like that.
But their stock also went up from this.
Yes, of course. Capital loves this shit. This is an article from, when was this? Dateline, August 23rd, by Lauren Hirsch and Maureen Farrell. This is a Farrell joint here. Of the New York Times. Corporate America's newest activist investor, Donald Trump. The president is demanding government stakes in U.S. companies and cuts of their revenue. Experts see some similarities to state-managed capitalism in other parts of the world. I'll just read a couple paragraphs here to set it up. Corporate America has built up defenses against the likes of Carl Icahn, Nelson Peltz, and other corporate raiders who have rattled the cages of chief executives, pushing for higher stock prices. Now companies have a new investor to worry about, the President of the United States. President Trump has inserted the government into U.S. companies in extraordinary ways, including taking a stake in U.S. Steel and pushing for a cut of NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices revenue from China. Last month, the Pentagon said it was taking a 15% stake in MP Materials, a large American miner of rare earths. And on Friday, Intel agreed to allow the U.S. government to take a 10% stake in its business worth $8.9 billion. These developments could herald a shift from America's vaunted free market system to one that resembles, at least in some corners, a form of state-managed capitalism. Oof. More frequently seen in Europe. Oof. And to a different degree, China. Oof. And Russia.
So we're on the slippery slope.
We're on the slope
to China.
All right, we're getting the China virus here,
and that's bad because.
Well, the article's very interesting because, you know, I read the New York Times mostly to like try to understand what the ruling class, or at least like the chattering class, and the governing class thinks about the world, right? And their main objection to this isn't so much the government interference, although that's bad. It's that. Shareholders and like corporate governance has no way of dealing with a guy like Donald Trump. You can't have shareholder and stakeholder democracy if you have this, the great power of the state, the great power of the presidency, the executive looming over you. So this is a tacit acceptance that Bidenism has failed. And it's even, I think, in my opinion, a tacit admission that the Liberation Day was a bust, that the tariffs policy of Trump trying to like individually negotiate with nations has failed at some of the major things they want to do. And so now in a typically haphazard personalist style, Donald Trump is taking ownership stakes, controlling stakes, or 10% stakes in some large American corporations citing national security. But for the people of the New York Times, for the business people, what's scary is that this isn't unprecedented, right? But what is unprecedented is that this isn't happening because of a systemic crisis or collapse like Obama did. Obama did a good thing when he bailed out the banks, when he took stakes in the banks, when he took stakes of the big three automakers, right? He was facing a collapse. He had to do something. This, according to them, is like voluntarism. It's voluntaristic.
But hold on. Trump isn't taking the stake. The Treasury is taking the stake?
The Pentagon's taking the stake in the rare earth thing. Uh-huh. And the Treasury, I believe you're right, is taking the $8.9 billion stake in Intel.
And the article also mentioned that Intel got, you know, trillions from the CHIP Act or some share of the trillions. So, I mean, one way to read it is if you just take, you know, the word Trump out of it and just like, this is just the state doing it.
Yeah.
They're getting something back for that huge giveaway.
Right. Yeah. And the giveaway, as I understand it, as part of the CHIPS Act, was basically mandating that Intel and all these other corporations that got the subsidies from it invested chip building capacity in the United States. Now, I know that Intel broke ground on a giant chip plant in Ohio, but I heard recently that they're backing out of it. And so I think this is some frustration of the U.S. state in the failure of Bidenism. If you imagine like Biden's CHIPS Act and IRA and all this good stuff, right? It's like that meme where the guy's poking the stick at something and it's like you're poking the stick at like tech capital saying invest. And like, why won't you invest, goddammit? And Biden was like poking this and subsidizing it. And they didn't invest because there's no profits in it, right? So now Trump comes along and is, again, haphazard and very kind of pragmatic in a very stupid, non-ideological way. He says, well, we gave them like all these billions of dollars. Now we're going to take a stake in it and we're going to force them essentially to invest, I guess is the implication of this entire thing. And also too, of course, when Trump went up against China in the trade war, like the budding low-intensity trade war a few months ago, and they cut off the rare earths, all of a sudden our car makers and our aerospace industry and a lot of the military-industrial complex all of a sudden just like fell flat on its face and couldn't produce. They couldn't get these advanced magnets, magnetic materials and alloys that come out of China. So China really has a chokehold on the American kind of advanced manufacturing economy. So by putting Pentagon money, presumably in an American rare earths company, you would be able to, I guess, force them to invest again. This is about forcing capital to invest when subsidies didn't work and when tariffs didn't work. This is like a third way to do it.
Because they have a seat at the table on the board?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
They take a stake, yeah.
And so you are, you know, what's your whole take on this? Is it you don't sound ultimately too concerned?
I mean, what's there to be concerned about? Like, if you're working for one of these companies, if you're working for Intel or you're working for what was the rare earths company? If you're working in their mines or whatever, does it matter if Donald Trump is cutting you your paycheck or if like mm-hmm. the private capitalists are cutting it for you? I don't know. I think as like a working person, it's whatever. I think that if anything, it shows like just how floundering and failing both Bidenism and Trumpism has been trying to deal with the various crises we've seen over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years or so. And my take on it, honestly, is that this is seen in the gray lady in the August New York Times as like a an undermining of corporate governance and like this Rubicon that we're crossing, the slippery slope. We might turn into Germany or, God forbid, China or even Russia, right? Russia, Russia, Russia. I think ultimately, as usual, this policy of Trump's will be rejected wholeheartedly. It'll be seen as like Putinism or communism or wherever, whatever people want to smear it with. And maybe they're right about that to an extent. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if President Vance is next or President Buttigieg is next, whoever like reasonable non-Trump person gets the executive office next, I would guess that they're going to like rationalize this policy. They're going to figure out a way to like take what is like a personalistic and haphazard policy and make a state policy, which is a lot of what Biden did, of course, in his post-Trump one term, right?
I also saw some speculation that this is something Intel might be able to wriggle out of post-Trump and say they were coerced into it, which does appear to be something of the case. But, you know, time will tell, you know, if there is even a post-Trump.
oh, yeah, maybe we'll have Trump again, and then maybe we can rationalize it in, what, 2032?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to talk about the this another New York Times article, big Times reader.
Me? I read it every day. It's my local paper. What am I supposed to read the Post?
We do live in New York. It's true. Yeah. So this is a something that's probably not surprising to any of our listeners, but the New York Times had a piece just a couple days ago about how the reason we're not seeing a lot of the alt-right street battle type stuff, the sort of stage set provocations in liberal cities, is because the alt-right is essentially in power, and they cite some of it's been 8 years since the Battle of Charlottesville. Mm. The alt-right really fractured after that, so I would give a lot of credit to the anti-fascists for stopping the sort of street-level momentum of the alt-right.
Mm-hmm.
However, those ideas were never the product of that street militancy. They have been, you know, racism, of course, has always been circulating inside and outside of the federal government, and in the policies of different presidents. And so the alt-right people are now saying, well, we don't really need to do something like Charlottesville or Torch March anymore because our guys are in power. And the most concerning thing that they cite there in terms of the connection between these like sort of street-level fascists and the presidency is that some of these executive orders are seemingly referencing directly things that like white nationalist shooters have said. And then the you know, ICE was recruiting publicly with a meme saying "Which way, American man?"
Right,
which is a reference to a white supremacist publication.
Yeah,
so you know they're being pretty open about it. What are your thoughts on the alt-right in power?
Well, I think that individual graduates, let's call them, of the alt-right have seemed to fill up the Trump administration, or at least in their comms, right? They seem to have a lot of young, edgy, kind of alt-right white nationalist types who are doing the memeing for like the Department of Labor and the memeing for the State Department and the memeing for DHS. Like, it's a lot of memes coming out of this fucking this government, right? And so that's where we're seeing their cultural influence, right? Because if they have anything, it's like dank memes, you know. I say that very ironically because it's really fucking corny and fucking cringe, all the things that are coming out, and partially scary as well too. I don't know. I think there's a big battle now, and we're going to talk about immigration too today. It's a big battle between the civic nationalists and the ethno-nationalists, and I feel like the ethno-nationalists were subdued in this country for a very long time, although they did exist, of course. They have existed through the entire time. And, you know, civic nationalism says, as Ronald Reagan once said, if you want to be French, you have to be a Frenchman. If you want to be German, you have to be, you know, speak German. But to be an American, you just need to like come here and like produce value and like be a productive citizen or whatever. And that was like an old style republicanism. That was like a bourgeois republicanism, like a very like republicanism. And now what started out, what we watched and what we commented on this show like 10, 12 years ago, this Charlottesville and its aftermath and the alt-right or whatever, now is gaining real purchase. And it's, I wouldn't say the dominant part of the MAGA movement, but it's like it's at least a big part of it, if not a majority, a plurality of the loudest voices.
Well, the MAGA movement will defend whatever Trump does. Right. So it's, you know, I think you can probably find a small fraction of Republicans who are appalled by ICE. You know, maybe the South Park Republicans don't like it so much.
Yeah.
But of course, the vast majority like that. This is what they voted for and they love it. And so it doesn't really matter if they are ideologically white nationalist or whatever. They appreciate whatever crazy shit Trump is doing. And if it happens to be, you know, directly out of the demands of a group like V-Dare,
yeah,
then that's fine. You know, if Trump happened, yeah, there's always been this hope that one day Trump might try to do some populist stuff like healthcare reform or something.
Yeah.
But you know, I think they would support that too if he were to do it, but he doesn't.
That's the high hanging fruit. That's tough stuff to do. I would say directly on Charlottesville, because that's kind of like the news peg for this piece, is the 8th anniversary. What was Charlottesville about? It was about defending Confederate statues. So in this like one particular issue, we've already seen that the statues are going back up, right? The ones that haven't been destroyed, and military bases are being renamed weirdly for Confederates. And, you know, basically like there's a real backlash, and we're seeing it work out like, you know, in town squares and plazas and museums everywhere, including the Smithsonian, where right they're like taking the woke out of the Smithsonian, shit like that. So on the very surface kind of cultural alt-right level, yeah, like total fucking victory, like cultural victory. They have the long arm of the state behind them now to put their dumb fucking like horseman statues back up.
I think it, to me, it seems like it's less, I think there's definitely some alt-right figures or some alt-right friendly figures that are in the administration, but I think it's more the kind of human biodiversity, Silicon Valley type white nationalists who, you know, couch their white supremacy and different ideas about IQ and genetics. And, you know, things like explicit anti-blackness are pretty settled. They believe black people are inferior. I think Trump believes this too. They probably believe Latino people are inferior. The big debate between them is Jews, because some of those people are Jewish, like Curtis Yarvin. They believe that Jews have a higher IQ.
Right.
So the JQ is sort of like unsettled between them. But in general, I think a figure like Stephen Miller might be a bit outside of this. He seems to have some esoteric, like more explicitly white nationalist beliefs, despite being Jewish himself.
Yeah, with refugee family members, if I recall correctly.
And I think in the first Trump term, there was always this tendency to look for these dog whistles and blast them out and say, look, this is what they're really saying. And it didn't really work, because a lot of people, you know, there's plausible deniability. I think it's pretty clear now that those were dog whistles, you know, the sort of build the wall and protect our children's future or whatever was clearly a reference to the 14 words. Yeah. I think it's safe to say that now. But, you know, what does it really matter? Because, you know, what would it matter if we, you know, if the alt-right really was defeated at Charlottesville? If those ideas were, you know, existed before Charlottesville and continue to gain prominence afterwards.
Yeah.
So the question is, like, how do we reconceptualize anti-fascism in a moment where this country is closer to fascism as it's ever been. We have essentially a fascist regime in power that wants to hold on to power as long as possible. So what does it mean now that the idea of anti-fascism that we have from the interwar period and from the first Trump term of fighting the fascists, you know, with like literally punching them, that's now off the table.
Yeah, no, you bring up Stephen Miller. I think it's important to bring up Stephen Miller. I saw a video of Stephen Miller some time ago where he was younger and he was in, I believe in high school. He was like Beverly Hills High School, I think he went to. And his background is that I think his father was in business or whatever, and his business failed. And then Stephen Miller kind of took this turn towards anti-immigration as a young man. But the video that I saw was him, I think, making a trolling speech that said, like, if you want to help the janitors of this school, you should just throw your trash on the ground because that's like a job creation program, you know. And he is this type of guy that you remember, I'm sure, Andy, from high school, and I remember from high school, who's like, he has this kind of smug shit-eating grin on his face as he's saying it, like he's not actually serious, he's trying to get a rise
already
out of people.
Balding at the age already of 17
at 17, like looks like shit, looks like a real shit eater, you know what I mean? And I saw this video and I recognized Stephen Miller as like a guy that you knew in high school. You know, I'm like about his age too. It was like this kind of like, I don't know, like class clown, sort of like try to get a rise out of everybody, like deeply unserious person, but uses serious arguments to get to troll people, as we'd say nowadays. That's not what they called it in the 90s, but that's what we'd say nowadays. And so I think Stephen Miller is like a deeply unserious person who's got himself into a situation where his ideas and his power is very serious. And so I think to the extent that there's fascism, and I do believe that there are elements within MAGA that are, it's a very weird postmodern fascism. A late fascism. This is not the fascism of the trenches of World War One. This is the fascism of like Beverly Hills High School fucking shit posters, basically, who are like kind of tongue-in-cheeking this whole thing. Like their memes are like all about dog whistles, but they like to keep it at the dog whistle level, most of them, because it's like funnier that way, and it's like not even serious when you're doing serious shit like fucking sending people to concentration camps in El Salvador. It's all a joke. It's all a big fucking joke.
That you know, I think this idea of late fascism, which comes from,
I never heard it before, late, not that Italian,
Alberto Toscano. Yeah,
thank you. Oh, it is, yeah, the so, Italian guy. Okay,
so yeah, the idea of late fascism corresponds to the idea of late capitalism developed by Frederick Jameson and Ernst Mandel. And just as you say, especially from Jameson, the sort of postmodern nature of politics, the postmodern period, the sort of identities that fueled the initial rise of fascism have broken down. So you could look at the interwar fascism in Italy or in Germany as between an ascendant workers movement and a defensive petty bourgeois, or, you know, the foot soldiers of the bourgeois class, or the monarchy, or what have you. Now we can't really say that because they're not really coming for the workers' movement. They're coming for individual workers. And Stephen Miller's major contribution so far during this term has been the vow to detain 3,000 people a day through these ICE raids. And I think it's really important we take a look at how that went. They used raids in Los Angeles as a model. Raids indeed did increase dramatically for a period of time, but have now dropped dramatically. Mm. So this is a chart from a site called Journalist Resource by Austin Kotcher. This massive increase in ICE detention starting in February 2025.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then it's steadily dropping through July, and it's still much higher than it had been pre-Trump.
But there's been a precipitous drop.
But a big part of that is because ICE is now doing detentions that the CBP was doing.
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't mean that like it's the same arrests by a different agency, because CBP, I think, made more arrests at the border. But yeah, what's important here is that the rebellion in LA and the dispersed resistance to the ICE raids everywhere in the country, the public shaming of it, maybe even the South Park episode, has had an effect on the efficacy of ICE. So if we're talking about what a late anti-fascism would look like to confront this late fascism in power, we have our first glimpse of that with LA and with this widespread resistance to ICE. And I think we're also beginning to see it in DC with the way people are resisting the federal takeover there and the homelessness sweeps.
Rax King and Anders Lee have both been doing great work on that as DC people. So shout out to them. Fundraising and whatnot with mutual aid groups. That's really good. You know, I think you're right that the rebellion in LA and elsewhere against ICE has had its effect. I think also, too, you know, we need to look at this from a state capacity perspective, because the state is both that which like distributes the Social Security, and the state is also that which like fines all the people that need to be deported, right? And our state has been kind of worn a little bit thin, let's say, over the last like 40 or 50 years. So some of that decline, I think, might be that the quote-unquote low-hanging fruit, and I don't mean to say that about immigrants, but like people that have been on the radar for a while and that ICE has had in their databases or whatever, maybe it was easy for them to come out the gate in February and start snatching those people up. But now they're perhaps running out of that. That's what I've heard anyways.
So this is some more reporting on this from Russell Contreras at Axios.
Yeah.
The decline followed protests. Okay. Arrests by U.S. immigration agents dropped by nearly 20% in July amid the backlash. The decline followed protests over waves of raids in June, particularly in Southern California, that led to court orders that have hindered some ICE operations. Another factor in the falling arrests, Trump's own flip-flop on whether to pause raids targeting agriculture and hospitality industries.
Right, right.
Meanwhile, removals of immigrants from the U.S. rose in July to an average of 84 more per day compared to June. So ICE agents numbers, they say they had an average of 990 arrests per day from July 1st to July 27th. So this is down from 1,200 arrests in June and far short of the stated goal of 3,000 per day. And they claim that the Trump administration appears to have backed off that goal, at least in court.
Interesting. I'd like to highlight something you said, and it's something that I remember happening now, which is agriculture and tourism, right? Remember when Trump did that flip-flop on that? ICE was going into like meatpacking plants, and it was going in and taking workers out of the fields who had been taking in crops and all that. It's very interesting. This is where I'm finding the most interesting material right now to think about. As this, it seems like this MAGA movement is this kind of, I hate to say it in a dark way, like a world historic thing. It represents like some backlash to the world that we knew for the last 50 years or so, neoliberalism, right? If you want to call it that. The fissures within this immigration debate are really interesting. And I think we highlighted this on the show around Christmas when, remember that big blow up there was within the right wing about H-1B visas, mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to see the fractures and fissures within the MAGA movement because it tells you something. And Trump, as this, because MAGA, as you said earlier, is this very personalistic movement, like whatever it is that Trump decides, most of these people will fall in line. The ambiguity and the flip-flopping there, I think, is like an ambiguity that exists like within the whole immigration debate, which is that are we trying to like use immigration as an economic, as a labor policy, right? I mean, anti-immigration is a labor policy. Are we trying to do it as a way to help capital? Are we doing it as a way to help labor? Like is immigration policy taking on much more than immigration policy can actually do? Because for the right wing, anti-immigration does represent for them like a catch-all that could be anything. Anti-immigration is supposed to be helping the American worker, the native worker. It's also supposed to be like every time you deport like a Guatemalan or a Central American or an African or a Haitian or whatever, it's supposed to be dropping rents and housing prices at the same time. Like, in their minds, just in the way that anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools, anti-immigration is becoming for them like a stand-in for all the sorts of problems that they see in our capitalist society and the way in their stupid addled brains that they can imagine confronting it. But then once you get to the actual situation where a businessman like Trump sees the meatpacking plant shutting down because you're taking all these hardworking people and you're fucking sending them back across the border. That's where...
Or just a meat eater like Trump.
Or just a meat...
What about my delicious meat?
What about my McFish sandwiches, right? Like, there's probably some immigrant labor that went into that entire thing. So it's very interesting to look at the debate over immigration as it exists within the MAGA movement right now and as it's being operationalized because... Like, these people, these fucking scumbags. If I can get mad for a second, do you mind if I get mad? I haven't had a rant in a long time.
Go off, King.
All right. So, like, I was talking about state capacity, right? Palantir, they're going to go in. They've already got the contract with Palantir, and they're going to rationalize all the different departments that exist in this country to create, like, a master database of all the people who are supposed to be here, all their contact information, all their banking information, all their everything, right? Where they work, where they live, whatever, where they go to church, presumably, too, right? I had a friend years back who married a woman for a green card. I won't name any names here, but she was really scared when the interviews were coming up because she's like, oh, well, I'm sure that the IRS is going to check with the DHS and then they're going to talk to this other agency and they're going to figure out that I'm lying. I'm like, we don't have that in this country. We're a free country. These departments don't talk to one another. Like, everything gets lost in the cracks. There's no state capacity here for, like, people to cross-reference your taxes with your fucking immigration shit. Like, that's not the kind of country we have. But this is the kind of country that these assholes are creating, that these right-wingers, quote-unquote, are fucking creating, where Palantir, where Peter Thiel is going to go in and create, like, a fucking Leviathan system. Where, like, these freedoms that we used to have, freedoms of privacy, freedom from the government, are being eroded because these capitalist scum, you know, these MAGA Republicans, they can't fucking, we as a society more broadly cannot fucking handle the contradiction between the nation state and capital itself. These immigrants being absolutely necessary for capital accumulation on the one hand, but running up against this, like, nation state, this idea of the nation state as a nation of laws and self-governance, there is like an irreconcilable contradiction there. And these motherfuckers who were talking in the 90s, I remember as a kid, about the black helicopters and the fucking the deep state
the FEMA camps, which they're absolutely right about.
They were absolutely fucking right about it now.
But now they love them.
And you have these cops wearing masks with no badges and fucking, like, I wish... I'm going to say this on here.
We're not going to say that.
All right. Sorry.
We're not going to.
Let me phrase this another way. Maybe you can beep out what I just said.
Yes.
I wish that these Second Amendment people that we heard so much from about the FEMA camps and the black helicopters in the 90s and the 2000s, the Alex Jones, the militia types, remember all these fucking people? I wish they would, like, take seriously the shit that they've been saying when a masked agent of the state shows up with a gun and no badge to someone's fucking house, or, like, stop somebody on the street. They do fucking nothing, and it's an embarrassment. These people are deeply unserious fucking
people. Well,
it's,
I mean, this is part of the theory of late fascism, which is there's a hatred of the state on one end and a desire for a exponentially stronger state on the other end. And I, you know, part of that is, I think, they believe someone like Trump will put their people who are traditionally outside of state influence into power. Another part of that, and another fissure that I think is worth thinking about, is, you know, you're talking about Palantir as sort of like serving a rationalizing function in, for example, checking people's social security numbers. Yeah. There's a rationality to the fact that employers are not able to do that, which is that we need undocumented labor for the economy to work.
Yes.
So the system has to be broken in that sense. So even with the raking stuff that the Trump administration is doing and the economic chaos it's causing to certain manufacturing and hospitality sectors, I think people like Peter Thiel look at this and say, well, at some point they're going to need us to come in and restore some sort of order, some sort of technocratic order to everything. And it possibly the ideological aspects of the anti-immigrant regime are just not as important as the ability to win the contracts and the positions to rebuild the bureaucratic infrastructure as they see fit.
Are you saying the tech capital is not going to save us?
I think there's a certain point where things will be so broken and they'll already have the contracts that they're the only things that, not us, but the state, they're going to be able to, they're going to be the bureaucracy. They already are contracted to rebuild the bureaucracy. So they're going to appear rational compared to the Stephen Millers and Trumps and the ideologues surrounding them.
Just like Biden appeared rational with industrial policy,
or they're going to appear they're going to appear neutral because a big part of this draining the swamp, retire all government employees thing, is the removal of the neutral aspects of the state, replacing them with people who are loyal, like psychos more or less, and hoping that everyone else who's still left over will just like. Have to work in that direction out of paranoia.
Now, I think that, I'm sorry, continue.
But yeah, these are capable people that they're getting rid of, and the people they're replacing are not going to be capable. So there's going to have to be, a restructuring of those capabilities in the bureaucracy.
I think what you're saying...
With neutral pretenses.
Yeah, I think the neutral pretense is really important because that was the Doge thing, right? And that's what the Palantir thing is that we can have, like, the bureaucracy is politicized, necessarily, because it's like within the state. So it's like this this plaything of the experts and the policymakers or whatever. But there is a neutral party, and it's fucking Elon Musk or it's Peter Thiel. These are like the adults in the room. Like, sure, they're technocrats as well, but they're going to use like supposedly neutral means, like AI or whatever.
Well, not Musk, but yeah, I think Palantir has the ability to brand itself as more neutral, and certainly. Sam Altman is like, that's kind of his lane, and Zuckerberg. Thiel and Musk might be too damaged, but they're also, but Palantir's winning these contracts because they're reaching a level of consolidation where they're just the best organization to contract with.
And I want to throw...
It's being used by law enforcement all over the world already.
Yeah, I want to throw another name out there, Alex Karp. Right, you know about this fucking monster, absolute fucking psychopath. What's his company?
Palantir.
He's also Palantir, right? He's like the more military industrial complex guy. He's the one that brags about how his AI is killing quote unquote Hamas terrorists. We have an imperial boomerang thing happening right now. And imperialism is really important to bring up here because one thing that you said, it struck a note with me, which is that, referred to late fascism when you talked about this. It's like the one side sees these aspects of the state as like really bad, but these aspects of the state really good. And you're talking about the right wing. Well, like the quote unquote left wing in this country feels the same way, right? Like they think the Social Security is good. They think the expertise within what the right wing calls the deep state is good. They think the Smithsonian University is good. They think the $50 billion that goes to Harvard every year is good. And they're probably right about a lot of that, right? But it's kind of like the unity of these two positions is, and what left and right means of this country is that you accept that there's good and bad parts of the state. You just completely disagree what those actually are. But I think it's important to like focus this again on like the working class and what's necessary to build a class movement, because this is of course the Antifada, right? Which is like, you don't, when we talk about imperialism, when Noam Chomsky talks about imperialism, when Chris Hedges talks about anti-imperialism, it's all good stuff. And there's great facts there. Gray Zone, awesome. Great reportage on the facts of the empire, right? But like, what is it that we here in the center of the beast, in the belly of the beast, feel when it comes to imperialism? Like, basically... The drive to destroy the American empire needs to be a self-interested one, because what imperialism is doing abroad is nasty. But then what it does to us at home is like the same fucking thing. It's two heads of the same coin. And so when we're arguing against imperialism, we should be arguing against this imperial apparatus that's been put up in order to manage all these crises that capitalism has been creating for the last 150, 200 years or so in this country. And I fall back on the FEMA camps and the black helicopter shit, because like that was like an older right that existed, a paleo right that existed in this country, and like was serious about actually putting up some sort of resistance to the technocratic bureaucratic destruction of civil society and like American life as represented by the imperial state. They were serious about that, or at least their foot soldiers were. Like that now seems like a rightism that like we could deal with, even though it looked terrible back then. What we have now is far worse. And it is like some weird amalgamation of like, I don't know, technocratic, like it's like the woke right. Have you heard this term, Andy, the woke right?
Yeah, but this is sort of more like pointing out the hypocrisy of their culture war. I don't think
it's deeper than
I don't think there's really justification, you know, in any sort of woke way to what they're doing on a state level. But although I do agree that another sort of late anti-fascist tactic is the valuation of associationism in various ways, because one of the things that happens during a fascist takeover is not only they get rid, you know, they put whatever group is on the chopping block into concentration camps or fire them from their jobs or make them non-persons in whatever way, but also that everyone who's left and everyone who has to continue working in the bureaucracy or otherwise begins to feel like they need to inform on one another to save themselves.
Right.
And only through durable associations that people have stronger connections to than the state, than the nation or the political project, is there meaningful resistance on that level where people just, for example, are not willing to inform on their coworker or even allowing someone who needs to hide, you know, a safe space to hide. So this is another thing that I think we have a leg up on the late fascists in this moment, is that people don't really give a shit about the American state or the American project. You know, people don't like our foreign wars. People don't like the ICE raids, even though they voted for them.
They don't like the state, really.
People don't like the state.
Yeah.
And so it's important for us. And this is something we'll get into in the Q&A. Let's move to the Q&A.
Yeah, let's move to the Q&A.
We don't want to cover too much territory. Yeah.
Sorry for ranting and raving there. It's not even just hypocrisy. I think it's an important thing to point out because I think there is a way in which, and we'll talk about this more in the bonus half, the way in which like American common sense about how like the relationship between society and the state is supposed to operate does tend towards something that's like libertarian and communist. And as a libertarian communist, I think this is like an interesting thing to know and for us to play with and work with as we try to figure out what the fuck to do.
All right, let's move to our Discord Q&A. What's going on with our guys and in some cases gals and in some cases neither or both?
Yeah, that's right. We'll see you on the other side.